And so the big story is that there's a spread, in the U.S., which is exchange for physical, and so it's essentially if you have metal and you want to sell the metal and buy forward, that's how that price is quoted. But people are doing it the other way around. If you have a futures contract, they want to take delivery of that metal in the U.S. so that they're through the tariff window before the before the window slams shut. They can't take a $750 risk on a trade that's getting, the spreads have gotten bigger. They could be $30, $40, $50, $60 in some cases to bring gold into the U.S., but nowhere near enough to take that kind of $750 risk. So that's what's been going on.
Keith Weiner, what's going on? Good afternoon, I think, to you. How are you?
Good morning. It is 8 a.m. here in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Okay, so good morning. It's 10 a.m. here in Atlanta, Georgia. So, boy, do we live in interesting times here. Wanted to know your thoughts specifically in the precious metals market, both gold and silver. We've been strong for a long time now. What I mean by that, at least I'm just going by memory, 12 months or so. What are you seeing in the marketplace? And is this just really a view of what's to come?
Yeah, interesting bundle of questions. I'm just reminded of the ancient Chinese curse, or alleged. I don't know if this is urban legend or if this is true. Made you live in interesting times. And boy, are we in interesting times, both politically and in the gold world. The obvious elephant in the room is the possibility of tariffs hitting gold and silver. Now, the reason why that's important is the market makers and trading houses that move metal around the world are responding to spreads that could be on the order of a few dollars an ounce for gold. There's a $5 spread between, Dubai and Hong Kong, and the trading houses will jump on that, and they'll buy it in Dubai and simultaneously sell it in Hong Kong and deliver it, whatever, 2 days later or something. And so betting on price, they're not speculators. And of course, they're using quite a lot of leverage, as much close to 100% as they can. So they're not prepared to take, any kind of major risk. It's just simply a buy here, sell there, trade. They make a few bucks on it and, move on. The same thing happens between New York and London, London and Zurich, London and Dubai, London and India. Dubai in India. I mean, it's trades are going on all over the world, and that's how these guys operate. And I talk a lot about gold carry, which is buy spot, sell forward, sell future, because there's almost always contango, which is a positive spread that is spot trades cheaper than futures. People may notice that now. If you look at a quote source that gives you the price of the futures market, you think, "Oh my God, we nearly hit 3,000," and then you look in the spot market and it's definitely lower, and oh, disappointed, right? So there's a spread between the two markets, and spot is London and futures is New York. That normally doesn't matter. I mean, the UK and the US are friendly. They were. We'll see politically where we're headed now.
Right.
Up seems to be down and left seems to be right, but there's open trade between the two. Gold goes on airplanes, right? Gold is so valuable, so value dense. It travels by airplane. It doesn't go by boat. And so if there's a spread between the two markets, the arbitragers will step in and fix that, compress that spread. But now there's the possibility of 25% tariffs. I have to say, so can I go on a little rant about tariffs,
Please.
at least in this context? I'm not going to address the broader issue because it becomes very political. It's amazing to me how many economics issues have become political issues. But specifically in precious metals, we have examples of poor countries, and yes, tariffs make countries poorer. Poor countries that have sizable import tariffs on gold, which is Vietnam and India. And we know what happens inside these countries, right? So in the US, we're used to very efficient markets whatever you want, you know, you buy it, whether it's Amazon, you call it Batmex or whatever, you know, to buy gold. It's very efficient. You can see the price on the screen. You know, you're going to pay a little bit of premium, but whatever, you know, it's delivered to your door or delivered to your, you know, depository or whatever it is, everything works. But in places like India, or Vietnam, with big import tariffs, the price of gold inside those countries can flip back and forth fairly rapidly between the world gold price or the world gold price plus the tariff, which can be, in the case of India, not too long ago, it was 16%. Now it's like 6%, I think. You know, India, that's the other thing. They change the tariffs fairly frequently. You can imagine if you get caught in the middle of a trade the day before, the day after the tariff changes, and, you know, you get creamed. And so what they do is they destroy a lot of traders who got caught, you know, wrong footed when there's a change that didn't anticipate. But the price can be flipping back and forth between the non-tariff price and tariff price, depending on whether Indian domestic demand is great enough to pull more from the, you know, global markets, or whether domestic demand is soft at that moment. And so you get a big, you know, teleporting of the price going up and down, and internal to the country, quite, you know, crazy volatility. And that's not an efficient market. That's a broken market. And that's what, you know, tariffs do. So if you have a 25% tariff, that's on the order of $750. So imagine the price of buying gold in the United States, plus or minus $750, depending on the day or even the time of the day. That's going to make gold less attractive to Americans, certainly, at least holding it domestically. That's going to play havoc with the dealers. You probably destroy a lot of dealers. And those that remain are going to have to figure out how to hedge that somehow. And hedging gets expensive. And so the buy, you know, the buy-sell spread, when you go to your dealer, you know, normally if you want to go in and you want to buy some Eagles and you're paying whatever, 3%, 4%, 5% over spot, and you sell it back and they're giving you spot or something like that, you're going to find that widens. They're going to charge 15% over spot. And when they buy back, they'll buy back at 500 or something. And everything will just get wider. The market becomes less efficient. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But if you're a trader, depending on this carry trade, you don't have to worry about this all of a sudden. And that was not a consideration up until Trump won the election. And so the big story is that there's a spread, you know, in the U.S., which is exchange for physical. And so it's, you know, essentially if you have metal and you want to sell the metal and buy forward, that's how that price is quoted. But people are doing it the other way around. If you have a futures contract, they want to, you know, take delivery of that metal in the U.S. so that they're through the tariff window before the, you know, before the window slams shut. They can't take a $750 risk on a trade that's getting, you know, the spreads have gotten, you know, bigger. You know, they could be $30, $40, $50, $60 in some cases to bring gold into the U.S., but nowhere near enough to take that kind of $750 risk. So that's what's been going on. It's been playing havoc with certain spreads, EFP, for example. Meanwhile, the basis is fairly high. The basis is the incentive to put on more carry trades. So there's parties putting out carry trades, and then they're trying to figure out how to de-risk it by, you know, importing the gold. They'd rather sit on spot gold in New York rather than in London, because then you're through the, if they slam the tariff, you're through the window, right? And so, you know, huge amounts of gold moving into New York. And it's interesting, you know, if you read Twitter, there's a lot of people that are trafficking in stories. I love this. If you look at gentleman in amnesia, so it's the phenomenon to describe, people read a story on page one of the newspaper, which is absurd. And they think, oh, these guys are idiots. And then they forget that. And at page two, they return to full credulity and they absolutely trust whatever they read on page two. And so if you look that up, there's a quote from in the Wikipedia entry, I think, and on gentleman in amnesia from Michael Crichton. And he's talking about, you know, this phenomenon, you read this newspaper story, and he says, it says, wet streets cause rain. The newspaper is full of them. And so there's all these sort of wet streets cause rain kind of stories about this. Now, this has something to do with repatriating, you know, the United States gold. Because they've read about, you know, Germany's repatriated gold and other central banks who repatriated the gold. The U.S. government has all of its gold domestically in the U.S. There's nothing to repatriate. It's our bid here. So that's absolutely absurd. And then, oh, that's because they're playing at a new gold standard and they want, gold in the United States to turn back to gold standard. This isn't gold that belongs in the United States. It ultimately belongs to the guy who buys the futures contract, right? So when we get to that a little bit, in the gold markets right now, and you're saying, what's going on? The retail coin and bar buyer has really gone on hiatus. And for a variety of reasons, as the price has gone up, right? So they're price sensitive. They tend to not like to buy at all-time high prices, especially, they have this long bear market from August 2011 through, at least 2018. That was a sell the blips market, not a buy the dips market. Every time people bought the blips, they got punished. All the usual suspects, every time the price of gold would blip, all the usual suspects came out and said, to the moon, that's it. That's just the rocket ship takeoff. Buy gold while it's still can. There isn't going to be anywhere, all that stuff. Everybody who bought on one of those episodes, for a trade, lost money. So after a while, I've trained the dogs. This is what's going to happen. If you buy when the price goes up, you're going to get green. And people are still trained. That training is still rules their psychology, I guess. But we're in a different market now. And for the moment, retail buyers in the West aren't believing that they've kind of gone on hiatus, or even they're selling back. The dealers are I wouldn't say swamped, but the dealers are definitely dealing with sellbacks. But there's other markets where, people are still buying gold, and the leveraged speculators in the futures market, and momentum traders, if they see the momentum, they see the price chart. And so they're into the trade. And so what happens is they bid up the price of futures relative to spot. Spread gets wider. That's the basis. The wider the basis is, the more attractive it is to the trading houses and market makers to buy spot, sell forward. And so you're getting this perfect storm of spread is wide because people are bidding the hell out of the futures. So let's put that trade on. And then they have to de-risk it. So you get this endless stream of gold coming over. There's nothing to do with the gold standard. It's not because the nations are competing for the world's gold supply. It's not because this is U.S. gold. It's not because gold is a quote-unquote tier one asset. Every time I hear that, I'm so tempted on Twitter. Every time I see that, to just respond. You do realize that tier one refers to banks' capital, not its assets. The liability side of the balance sheet, not the asset side of the balance sheet. Like Basel III punishes banks that own gold as an asset. It says 85% of the funding to finance that gold asset has to be so-called stable funding, which is equity or long-term bond, very expensive. So the opportunity cost under Basel III for banks to hold gold as an asset is very high, which is one reason why the banks are exiting. Bullion banks are shutting down, not banning the trade. Anyway, so gold's coming in because of this, phenomenon, this fear of, you want to do the carry trade because the basis is high, but if you hold in a spot in London, there's a fear that you can get creamed with a 25% loss. So the way to risk it is to import the gold into the U.S. where you're not going to be subject to that tariff anymore. And so that's what's going on. And that's causing all kinds of gyrations in the gold market in London and elsewhere. And all kinds of, rumors and conspiracy theories and beliefs that the gold standard is, they're secretly planning to be opposed to gold standard or something like that. None of which is, even on the horizon right now.
Okay. So a lot of stuff going on that. And I have some questions here. It's really I just want to put this in a nutshell. This is primarily tariff driven, correct? In your opinion?
Yeah. All that movement of gold into the United States. And by the way, it's also coming from Asia. As I read a story about Metalor's refinery in Singapore and they were saying most of their, and they produce kilo bars, most of their output is coming to the United States at the moment. So yeah, this is absolutely
tariff driven.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on that, how would you explain, I'm just trying to get to the bottom of stuff. How would you explain the run up before the election then?
So leaving aside the whole tariff thing, there's the whole monetary system thing.
Right.
Obvious that every currency in the world it's just being abused by the issuers.
Right.
I think this is what we as Americans tend to focus on, the problems in America, because we're living in it. And also, you know, say what you will about it, America is by far the most transparent. That is, our problems are magnified, put up on the giant and, you know, 80-foot screen, you know, magnified for everybody to examine. And most other countries are significantly more opaque. So, you know, we tend to focus on the problems in the U.S., but the problems are global. And so, at the same, you know, the solution to that, the whole tariff-driven, you know, the movement of gold from London to the U.S. is the problem that people around the world are just grasping for, you know, something to hold. They don't think it's going to go down in value. And the dollar, you can use the analogy, is the least dirty shirt. It's also a dollar world. I mean, there's one global currency, that's the dollar. All the other paper currencies are just local paper script. You know, it's like going to, you know, the 19th century, going to a company town, a coal mining town in West Virginia. And the people there might have thought that that paper script was money. You know, but if you lived outside that town and you just visited, you know, stopped on a railroad stop there, you realize how provincial that was. It's a global dollar world. And the dollar is on both sides of every major balance sheet in the world. Not true for any other currency. But every currency, including the dollar, is just obviously going to be going down more and more and more. And I don't think the world believes that, you know, the U.S. is going to get its fiscal deficit in order. And I know we have Doge now, and they're making some noise about it. Regardless of whatever you think of the politics of it, I can say as a monetary scientist, somebody who studies money as a science, is that the deficit and the debt necessarily must grow exponentially in order for the system to hold together. That's kind of intrinsic to the design of an irredeemable currency system. On top of that, the world depends on the issuer of the world's reserve currency, which is the dollar, to even to run massive fiscal deficits. This is the Triffin dilemma identified by Robert Triffin in 1960. This is how it has to work. This is how the system is wired. You don't like that, we shouldn't have a worldwide regime of irredeemable paper fiat currency. It is what it is. And so, you know, when you look at deficits at the level they're at now, and you think, well, it can only grow from here, yeah, people are starting to, in a greater way, we've had several waves, right? So after 2001 was a bit of a wake-up call, and some people started to get into gold. And that began the long bull market, which is really just a bear market in dollar. Just a mirror image. You know, it's like we're sitting on the deck of a boat, which is both slowly sinking, and there's a big storm, and we're going up and down in the waves. And we're saying, why is the lighthouse going up and down and mostly up? We got to invert that in a more objective, you know, point of view. But well, that began, you know, around 2001. And that was the end of, you know, central bank gold selling. Obviously, famously or infamously, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown, in the UK sold half the UK's gold, kind of marked a low point, both in terms of the world's gold market as well as gold price and UK policy.
What was the pound, I might add.
Yeah. And, you know, and then 2008 was another wake-up call, and a lot more people came to gold then, including yours truly. You know, COVID was another one, and now we're in this sort of post-COVID, you know, reality. People are discovering gold and saying, okay, I need to hedge, you know, the insanity, the madness. And, you know, in other countries, I talked about Turkey, China, and India, they're trying to hedge the madness of their own governments and their own paper currencies. And it's primarily an anti-dollar play. In fact, those people are trading for dollars when they can. Their capital controls, you know, they're limited in ability to get dollars. And so gold is one thing that they turn to. But there are plenty of players around the world, and certainly certain central banks and in the Arab world, where people are buying gold, not as anti-local currency play, but as somewhat of a protest against the dollar. Because there's no story, there's no possible way, no theory that says, yeah, the dollar is going to get better as a currency. Will it get better relative to the euro? Yeah, sure.
That's your right.
You have two, you know, Milton Friedman talked about floating currencies. It really should be called free-falling currencies. But if you throw a wooden board and throw a brick over the edge of a cliff, and you put a cannon on the brick, right, but you know, looking up, you're going to see the board appears to be rising. That's because the terminal velocity of a brick is higher than the terminal velocity. There's more air friction on the board relative to the mass. Right? So, if it was perfect vacuum on the moon, they'd both fall at the same rate. But in air, you know, the brick falls faster. So, relative to the euro, relative to the pound, or whatever, the dollars going to appear to be rising from those vantage points. So those are other shifts in that same storm, and they're sinking faster than the dollar is sinking. That's all it is. But is the dollar itself going to get objectively better? No, it isn't. There is no, how would you even manufacture a story that says, yeah, the dollar is going to get better every day? Because Trump's going to do this, and Doge is going to, they're tinkering at the margin. You know, they find some contract where there's waste. And, you know, when I found that there was some office had 500 licenses to Microsoft Exchange 365, and they only had 300 employees using it. Okay, sure, that should be cut. I mean, who can argue it shouldn't be, right? But that's not going to cure, let alone reduce a $2 trillion deficit to zero, right? So the dollar is, you know, getting worse and worse, and people are turning to gold. And this is a very different dynamic. If you remember back to 2009 to 2011, the gold trade at that time was fear of what? Rising consumer prices. People thought, look, all this quantitative easing is a big increase in the quantity of what we call money. That's going to cause, by Milton Friedman's axiom, if you want to call it that, it's going to cause consumer prices to skyrocket. Buy gold as a hedge against that kind of inflation. And when that inflation, so-called, didn't materialize, then the trade was off. And there's no point owning gold. So that was that trade, and that's why that lived a couple of years, and then it was done. 2009, 2010, 2011, mm-hmm. mid-2011, it was spent. Dissipated. And this trend is different. This is a, you know, the central banks are in, you know, in a jam, and the currencies are, you know, terminal or certainly getting worse anyways, and there's no way out. And so people want to own gold as an alternative to that. That's a different trade. And obviously it's had quite durable legs as we've gone up, you know, nearly $1,000. And I don't see an end. You know, so I think there's a correction likely coming just because markets don't go in a straight line, even bull markets. And then all the gold bugs that thought, you know, that's it, don't buy the book because, you know, it's going to correct. Then they have their chance to buy it a little cheaper if they choose to. And then, well, you know, as you said, November, it just resumes, just relentless. And I think that's the mode that we're in right now.
Okay. So you laid out very well, I might add, really systematically your thesis on the rise here. And I just want to recap that. So I just want to make sure that I understand it here. And then first of is tariffs. That's this last move that we've seen. That's what this move is the reason for this move. The second reason it's just really the longer term trend. It's not because the dollar is going to go on a gold standard. It's because all central banks, including the dollar's going to be there. It's just the bad shirt of the lot. But all central banks are going to be creating a lot of liquidity because they have to create a lot of liquidity. That's what you're saying, correct? And that's the reason for this rise.
I put less emphasis on the quantity and more on the quality. So the whole world is the quantitative standard or quantitative theory of money. I would say there's a handful of us in the world that would uphold the quality theory of money. And my concept of inflation is very simply, it's counterfeiting or monetary fraud. And, you know, if you borrow money, you know, in a business context or a government context, you should be borrowing money to finance an asset that generates return. Whether, you know, if you're a government, and not that I think government should be in the business of generating power, but you're building a power plant. That's something that's going to generate revenue for a very long time. And so to borrow against that, it kind of makes sense. What governments are increasingly borrowing is to just dole out more and more and more welfare. There are more and more, you know, groups of people that are just marginalized and you know, rendered unemployable by a combination of regulation and whatever. And they just are obliged to keep feeding these welfare states that are just growing, you know, massively. You know, that kind of borrowing is a counterfeit, it's a fraud. because they have neither the means nor the intent to ever repay it. And so the quality of the, you know, the assets, you know, that are being, you know, being purchased by the government debt, or for that matter, by the central bank, the quality of the asset is declining, degenerating. And that's the thing I'm really trying to put my finger on. It's a declining quality issue, not an increasing quantity issue. Now, this also has a finite, you know, end. Whenever the government interferes in the market, they always push people to do something that's not economic. I mean, that's the whole point. That's the feature, not a bug, of government intrusion. It's okay, we don't want you to buy, you know, steel made in Canada. We want you to buy steel made, you know, over here. Okay, fine. So now we have uneconomic production of steel at higher cost here, you know, comparative advantage. This is Adam Smith stuff going back, you know, 250 years. And, you know, you always get a reduction in coordination and ultimately productivity because the most efficient means of production is removed, taken off the table by the government. And so, you know, you're shifting the business from doing the best producer to the second best producer. Okay, fine. And everyone's slightly poorer by it. But it's not unstable. I mean, that can go on for generations or centuries. And the government messes with the money. You're messing with the signal that everybody uses for everything. Because everyone's profit and loss is measured in money. Everyone's balance sheet is measured in money, which means long-term decisions about investment are measured improperly or incorrectly, you know, deceptively, right? It misleads. And so that's why it's unstable. And you get, you know, perverse consequences that can come years or decades later. And so there is a finite denouement. There's a finite, you know, terminus to this thing, which is we're incentivizing a variety of means the destruction of real capital. And, I don't think we're in the dollar. We're not close to that end right now. But there's an end where, yeah, eventually the dollar's not going to be here. It's going to fail. Last, right? So all the other currencies will fail sooner. So the dollar will get stronger relative to euro and pound and yen and yuan and everything else. You know, people can see the early edges of that and they want to hedge that exposure. So I don't want to be all in on the thing, which is good. And it's not going to fail today. You're going to wake up tomorrow morning and, you know, find out the dollar is done. But it's going down by degrees and you know, can see it. And, you know, so everyone measures the price of gold, right? It's just, okay, well, gold is whatever, 29.50 or something. We like to measure price of the dollar in gold, which is over 1500 milligrams, 1.5 grams in 1913. And now, you know, with 10 point something milligrams, it just keeps going down and down and down. And, anyway, I don't know if I answered your question or if I just wandered off.
Yeah, you did. And this is why I like talking to you, because you really push my thinking. And it's like I'm talking to Milton Friedman. I say that with or Adam Smith. I say that with the highest amount of affection and respect. And you don't make it complicated. You actually draw it down and make it easy. But enough of that. You said something that I absolutely agree with. And not that I disagree with anything you said. But you said something that I absolutely agree with, that it's all relative. Yes. And I've really come around to that point of view. And I'm talking in dollar terms, probably within the last 12 months. I have a really good friend who is an American, but he lives in Australia, or I lived in Australia. He is an attorney, an international attorney that deals with manufacturing, specifically in Southeast Asia and China. And this is anecdotal, but his point of view is the dollar's not going anywhere, because I talked to every single manufacturer, but all these manufacturing companies, all of these other people, and all, what do they want? They want dollars, Andy. They want dollars relative to their currency. And they'll take that even more than gold, not as a store of value, but as it's the most liquid asset that there is.
Okay.
And then they'll go buy land, gold, or whatever whatever the hell they want with it, right? But they want dollars immediately. That's what they want. That's not going away because that's how the system is set up. So his point of view was, you can bricks all you want. It's not replacing the dollar. It might in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, whatever, 50 years, 100 years, we don't know. But right now, it's not going anywhere. That was his whole point of view. Another thing, though, that you're really pushing on is, and I would agree too with you, is this whole idea, and I think we're seeing it, is dollar rising relative, again, to other currencies, but also gold rising. Right? Relative to all currencies. So yes. So I really
got let me integrate that. See, your gold is the lighthouse, right, on the rock, and the dollar sinking relative to gold, and the other currencies are sinking relative to the dollar.
Yes. Yes. No, that's exactly right. You brought that up 20 minutes ago. So I want to think of it like that, because I think that's the proper way to think about it. What I'm having trouble with, I mean, not trouble, what I'm confused about, and I'm going to get political with you, not so much party political, but this idea of tariffs. I'm going to agree with what you said and just the free marketers. I'm a free market Austrian, okay? Just put that out there. But I guess when you base tariffs relative to this idea of free trade, because it's not really free, that's number one. And then not to say that we have to make something bad or protect the American worker because Vietnam or China or Mexico or Canada is not really free trading with us. We have to slap a tariff. I'm not advocating that, but the whole idea of free trade, well, it's not free to the US. That's number one. Number two is relative to an income tax. Is a tariff that much worse relative to an income tax? And right now we have both, but if we were supposedly get away from income tax, what would you rather have, an income tax or a tariff?
Leaving aside the question, do I believe they would actually repeal the income tax when they add the tariff, which I don't, but, you know, the tariff question.
I threw a lot at you.
The tariff question itself is pretty simple. And that is, the country is best off not slapping tariffs, even if its trading partners do. And I realize there's an ego thing that says they're doing it, we got to do it back.
Yeah.
No. But anyway, leaving that aside, I wanted to touch on, you know, the idea of, you know, what it protects. So take steel production, for example. So you're obviously protecting, it was a Bethlehem Steel, U.S. Steel. There's a couple of big steel companies, not very many, by the way.
Right.
And the unionized workforces are probably a total of thousands or maybe 10,000-ish employees. And so that's what you're protecting, but you're harming every U.S.-based manufacturer that manufactures anything that uses steel. All the automakers, there's two motorcycle companies in the United States, which is Harley, and it's also Indian, right?
Right.
And, you know, companies that make construction materials. Yeah. You know, beams and even just metal studs for every time you go to an office or a retail place, the studs behind the walls aren't wood, they're steel.
Yeah.
The things that are made out of steel. And, you know, just whole industries that depend on that. You probably have a million workers and 10,000 firms, you know, to protect three firms and 10,000 workers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everything the government does, I remember reading once they were talking about daylight savings. This applies to so many different things. And so she had a picture of this old, like, Indian chief. And he says, daylight savings is like cutting a strip off the bottom of the blanket and sewing it to the top. And, you know, I took daylight savings and I'm like, that's such a great analogy for everything the government does. Let's take tariffs here. And even leaving aside that if you're in the automotive manufacturing business, or you're manufacturing washing machines or something, that your interest is being sacrificed for the large benefit of somebody else, getting back to collectivism. Even that aside, that's okay. You know, people are not fungible. I don't want to give up my interest because someone else's interest allegedly benefits from it. But leaving that aside, the analogy of cutting the strip off the blanket and saying at the top is perfect because, of course, there's a loss. right? The blank is this long. You make this cut at both ends. You know, if you only think about fabric, right? Both ends have to be folded over and sewed and make like a seam and a hem. Right. So you're able to lose probably half an inch of total blanket length by playing that particular game. You're fooling yourself. And the same thing here. Like, yeah, you're protecting two or three or four steel companies and 10,000 workers, but you're harming hundreds or thousands or 10,000, I don't know how many companies are manufacturing things that use steel. Everybody's making roof trusses out of steel. Everyone was making steel sheds and steel buildings. Everyone was making, you know, whatever out of steel, you know, is being harmed. And so it's not a zero sum game. It's actually a negative sum game. Everyone is actually worse off as a result of this. You know, I certainly hope that, you know, this tariff madness ends, or if it doesn't end, then at least people come to be more aware of the issue. And then, you know, we give a change in policy, you know, sometime in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I would completely, not to interrupt you, but I completely agree with you, assuming that the income tax is not repealed. If the income tax is repealed, and I don't think that it will, just for the record, I'm confused about it because we have to govern, right? That being said, again, go back to my original comment. I am free market libertarian Austrian, okay? Just put that out there. And I don't think we should have either tariffs or income tax, okay? But again, if I had to pick an evil here, I'm not sure I'd pick an income tax over a tariff, if that makes sense.
The problem here is the absolute dollar amount that they're raising the income taxes today. What is it? It's on the order of $4 or $5 trillion. I remember researching this for something I wrote a couple of months ago, but it's not on the top of my mind. It's a massive amount of money. And when you take a look at total imports, I think something like you'd have to have a 70% tariff.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I agree with you. Yeah.
You never raised that amount of revenue with it. And so, you know, I have to kind of ironically or sardonically observe that it's like Schrodinger's tariff. On the one hand, it's supposed to disincentivize imports. It's supposed to encourage companies to close their foreign factories and open up in the U.S. And at the same time, it's supposed to raise revenues.
Yeah.
Like, pick one, but not both.
Right.
It's hard to beat. And if it was a 70% tariff, you would see a massive reduction in imports because consumers can't afford it. Most manufacturers would be totally uncompetitive if they had to deal with that. And so whatever revenue, and this is the thing that always, you know, befuddles and beguiles the tax planners. I remember when the Laffer curve used to be more talked about, you know, no one talks about that anymore. And the Office of Management and Budget or whatever, some authority would say, if we raise this, you know, raise the tax by this amount, then we're going to get this much revenue. And it never happened that way. Because they always made an assumption that everything in the economy is a static quantity, because we can look at the snapshot as it is at this moment. And we could just play with one variable and make that one variable totally uneconomic for millions of economic actors. And we're not going to get any changes other than the one change that we're hoping for. And it's never realistic then. So then they call the law of unintended consequences, blah, 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 right? And, you know, that used to be well understood, but the same thing's going to happen with tariffs. You can't tax something like that much without getting massive change in behavior. You never get the revenue. So what I say is, step one is you got to cut the spending. Mm-hmm. And if you cut the spending, it'll be easy and it'll be a fun exercise to figure out how to cut the tax. No one's really on board with cutting the spending. And let's cut spending. As long as you keep it safely at general and abstract, where we're not going to get any specifics. Everybody, and I met plenty of liberal Democrats, and of course I'm not government waste, I'm not for, you know, excess government spending. Paul Krugman, you know, in his debate at Freedom Fest against Stephen Moore, he said, you know, the misnomer, I'm not for big government. Paul Krugman was saying this. He's never met a big government program that he disliked, but in the abstract, it can, you know, say for like plausible deniability, right? You get specific is where it all breaks down, because you have the majority who is number one diffuse, and the people that benefit from that program are highly concentrated. And they're jumping up and down screaming, don't you dare cut our vital program, whatever it may be. You know, a 4-H program for kids to study the infectious proclivities of snail darters or something like that. And that's $1 million subsidy or something. But for those kids that are, those, you know, Boy Scout troop leaders that are benefiting from that, don't cut it, right? But then everyone else gets this hangdog, you know, gaze their navel, shuffle their toes on the carpet kind of thing, guilt about, well, you know, we have to, you know, subsidize science and the arts, and we have to have a social safety net, and we have to do that. You have to do that. And nobody can really, you know, argue against that. So my one political observation for this, you know, show is to say that, look at what DOGE has said and what they haven't said. They said they're going after waste. What they haven't said is, how do you define waste? Right? So the left has immediately jumped on it. They define waste. If there's a billionaire who hasn't been taxed at 100%, that's a waste. And, you know, I think everyone can agree that if there's a government office that has 500 software licenses, only 300 employees using that software, yeah, that's waste. You're not going to get to $1 trillion in savings by cutting that out. So, you know, there's a sense that they're saying, okay, cut USAID and cut, what the hell is the other one that just cut recently? It was talking about cutting the Department of Education.
Education, yeah. They haven't done it yet, but yes. And the defense, they've been talking about cutting defense. Which right. Was...
You know, okay, so, but now you're getting into different definition of waste, which is programs we don't like. Okay, that's fine. I mean, if you want to cut the Department of Education, that's, if I made a list of all the agencies to be cut, that would be one of them. To be zeroed up, to be eliminated. But if you just want to say waste, you haven't really said what this is all about. You really stand for. And therefore, it's not going to really have legs because it just all breaks down into partisan squabbling and everyone's definition of waste is different. There hasn't been any kind of statement of first principles that we're trying to cut things that are improper for government to be doing in the first place. And of course, that would be pandemonium, you know, because you can't say that. That's outside the window. You know,
right.
You know, that there is such a thing as improper, you know, area for government to be involved in is pandemonium. So you can say waste, it's relative to space. Within the Overton window, everyone can agree on cutting waste, but I don't think it can politically go anywhere because there are too many partisans who want that waste. It's to them, it's their vital program.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. I guess that there's one thing I would say is I've been pleasantly surprised though that a lot of things have been cut. I did not expect that. But to your point, you cut a program that had cut 500 Microsoft licenses for a company that needs 300. You know, what is the bottom line? It's a pebble in the on the beach, you know, it's meaningless, if you said, like you said. So let me ask you again, what's the end game here? Is it to, in your mind, is it just more of a mess? Is it more of just, okay, we're going to have momentarily, it looks like higher gold prices, or are you seeing buying and silver prices really? Are you seeing buying from the rest of the world? You see that holding up once this tariff issue, I guess, is in place and we have all this gold in New York. What happens, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
The tariff thing doesn't really affect the price and affects certain spreads.
Yeah.
So it's almost a way of a slideshow, although in the gold market, it's very important because it, you know, live or die based on that stuff. I think the world is buying gold, and I don't think that's going to go away. Right? I think this is durable. I think we're in a very different market reality versus 2012 to 2018. The psychology is still, you know, brutalized by that, you know, bear market. But I think it changed. And, I think there's significant players who are buying gold. Now, one thing that's worth talking about is, you know, Monetary Metals, we follow the basis. We publish the basis every day. There's a free graph on our website for this. The basis is the spread between spot and futures. And there's a ton of theory that you can talk about. And I've written, I don't know how many words, hundreds of thousands of words on it, probably over a decade and a half. But at a very simple mechanical level, right, there's futures and there's spot, and usually it's like this. If you see that futures is rising relative to spot, then you know one of two things is happening. Either spot is being pushed down, so they're selling the metal, or there's buying of futures. That's what's causing that spread to widen. You know, if the price is going up, obviously it's buying futures. The price is going down, it's selling the spot, if that spread is widening. So what we saw for most of 2024 was a rising price, and the basis was holding steady, which meant that it was not, wasn't traders in the futures market that were driving it. And that's what was driving, every time there was a price blip, 2012 to 2018, you could see that spread widening. It was the futures market buyers that got excited, and they thought they were front running a big move. And the, you know, I wrote many, many times, they were front running only themselves. And it wasn't durable, and then we move it reverse. And of course, those who bought in early and sold to, you know, near the top made money, and everyone else lost. Today, anyway, so 2024, for most of it, you could see that the basis holding steady and the price was rising dramatically. And that was quite a durable move. And you could see that in the basis data. Then late in the year, I don't have the, you know, exact chart in front of me at the moment. I'm just talking off the cuff. But late in the year, all of a sudden, the basis was really rising. And that's not a good sign. Now that means that it's leverage traders in the futures market. And by definition, that's, those are short-term positions. They're using leverage. Mm-hmm. Either going to take profits or they're going to cut losses. It's not a long-term hold position. If someone buys a coin and takes it home, they could hold that for 20 years. Someone futures on 20-to-1 leverage, they can hold that for 20 minutes.
Or right.
20 days, maybe, but not. But reversed, right? So a little bit of price correction, but the, and even in the face of continued rising price, the basis has come down. And so that says, okay, yeah, there's durable gold buying all around the world. And whether it's Turkey, China, India, Arab world, people are buying the physical metal. They just want to get their hands on metal, which means they just want to get rid of some of those dollars that are sloshing around. Mm-hmm. And whether it's fear of the local currency, whether it's fear of the dollar, whether it's fear of U.S., you know, monetary hegemony, with all kinds of different reasons, whether it's belief there's a gold standard coming or a desire for a gold standard. And by the way, those are two different things. A lot of people might want to, I mean, individuals, not people who run our governments, not the majority of voters, but there's people out there that would like to see, you know, gold, you know, some sort of gold standard return when they buy gold. And if they're going to buy the gold and hold it reasonably long term, then you get a durable price move. But if we're in a durable bull market, will there be a correction? Increasingly, I think, yeah, probably. But the way the basis is moving at the moment, you know, my expectation of a correction and my, you know, read of the basis are kind of diverging. I mean, you kind of have to expect a correction at some point. Look at how much the price of gold is moving. We're sitting near 1,000, and a year ago, we were sitting closer to 2,000. That's a big move. Surely ought to be a correction. Just without knowing anything about the gold market today or what's going on in the world, if you just know markets, you've been studying price charts and looking back to the 1920s, expect the correction. And there probably will be, but the correction is not going to change anything fundamentally. Just okay, yeah, there'll be some selling, you know, traders will unload or whatever. And but the fundamentals remain, you know, remain strong.
Heath, people want to do business with you or find out more about you. How do they go about doing that?
So we're all about paying a yield on your gold. If you'd like 3 or 4% return on your metal, go to monetary-metalsofness.com. And on Twitter, I'm at Real Keith Wiener, which is KeithWeiner. You're imposters. I like to misspell my name and try to siphon off followers from that. I'm prolific, but I post relatively frequently on, you know, controversial stuff and gold stuff and Bitcoin stuff and all that.
Yeah. Keith, you're one of, if not the smartest guy I know in this space. Agree or disagree with you. And I would say I agree, and then I'm agnostic, meaning I don't know what to think, but you always make me think. And I'm just very, very grateful of that. And what's going to happen now is for the rest of the day, I'm going to be thinking about it. So, but I really enjoy our time. I really do. This is the third or fourth time we've done this. So I'd love to have you on again shortly in the next quarter or so.
All right. Let me know.
All right. Keith Weiner, Monetary Metals. Great to have you. I'll put everything in the show notes, both on the YouTube as well as the Apple Podcasts, as well as Spotify.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, brother.
Bye-bye.